With all the work that you have done for those people, all the hours you put in, the effort.
It's not the company, Bess. They're not the ones that are forcing this.
They aren't. They picked 7 Jews.
The entire government of the United States is leaning on them. The administration of a popular president is telling them to cooperate in a new program of national importance. You think a life insurance company can stand up to Charles A. Lindbergh? The big man in the little plane?
That's Zoe Kazan and Morgan Spector from the HBO miniseries, The Plot Against America. It's based on the 2004 novel by Philip Roth that envisions an alternative history in which Charles Lindbergh defeats Franklin D. Roosevelt in the 1940 presidential election. David Simon is the man behind this reimagining of Roth's novel. David is best known for his work as writer, producer, and creator of the critically acclaimed, groundbreaking HBO series, The Wire. We caught up with David via Skype, so please excuse a few of the digital gremlins, as he told us what he thought of Roth's novel the first time he read it.
I thought it was interesting. Some people think he was writing to the allegory of George Bush, but I don't think so, and I think he denied it. I just thought it was an artifact of history. It was an interesting alternative view of what might have happened at a critical moment in American history. And it was pretty well researched. I mean, you know, Lindbergh really was the candidate that Roosevelt feared. And he feared it because of the simplistic message of anti-immigration, anti-xenophobia, isolationism, fascism isn't all that bad. That was scary. And that made Roosevelt vulnerable.
David, your adaptation focuses on the Levin family. Can you tell me a bit about the Levin family?
In the book, it was the Roth family, and Philip Roth used his own family as the narrative force to explain this dry run at American fascism. He imagined the events of his alternative world colliding with the lives of his parents, his older brother, and himself, as well as some extended family members, his young nephew Alvin, and his aunt Evelyn, his wife's sister. And so you experience this totalitarian maneuver and this Lindbergh administration and all of what goes awry in America from the point of view of this one lower middle class family in Newark, New Jersey, in the Jewish section of Newark.
Alvin can't bear your Nazi-loving president. That's why he left. You know, not so long ago, you couldn't bear the man either. But now what? Stock market is up. Profits are up. Business is booming. Everything else about Lindbergh, what he stands for, is forgotten. What else matters to you, a businessman, if the money is right?
Boy, you know, you sound just like the stupid kid, what else matters? Do your boys matter? Sandy, you want him to come home one day like that? How about Philip? You want him to wind up in a grave in France or wherever the hell else? We are out of the war. We're staying out of the war. Lindbergh, he's done no harm to any of us, as far as I can see.
You know, that's the thing, Monty. You don't see much outside of your own little world.
Sounds improbable, but it's actually brilliant. And what it does is it makes us live as individuals through the notion and through the moment of us losing our republic. And what would we do? What would we stand up and say? What would we do? What risks would we take personally? And that's the ultimate question. I mean, we've all played that game where we said, you know, what if slavery was going on? What would I have done in 1859? Would I have been John Brown, or would I have been hunting John Brown? If I was in Germany in 33, would I have stood up to the Nazi goons, or would I have acquiesced? We all like to think of ourselves as heroic. But we basically use the family to ask ourselves the same question.
Mm-hmm. How similar is the Levin family to the Simon family that you grew up in?
Culturally, they're the same. The dynamic in the family, my father did not have the fulminant anger of Herman Levin. But in the Simon family, we were brought up to argue politics, to argue with each other. Arguing was sport in my family. We enjoyed it very much. It was not a point of tension. It was, in fact, how you got attention.
I've read that the tagline for your series actually comes from your father, Bernie Simon. Can you tell me about that?
My father was the public relations director for B'nai B'rith, a Jewish service organization, for about 30 years. Before that, he worked for the Anti-Defamation League. He was basically a professional Jew. And, of course, I sat through many years, probably 45, 50 years, maybe more of him leading the Passover Seder, the Passover celebration, the meal. And at a certain point in that ritual, he would always point out that democracy and freedom, these are things that are never completely won. That every day you have to go out and kill a few more snakes. Every day you have to assert for the rights that you have. That was a lesson he never failed to let what was effectively the Jewish holiday of freedom, Passover, go without making that argument. So, yeah, it came to me as we were trying to find something to put on the one sheet.
Yeah, freedom is never completely won, but it can be lost. Yeah. This is the first time you've adapted a work of fiction. Was that part of the appeal of creating this series?
It was a little mortifying because it was Philip Roth. This is a lion of American literature, a guy who at the end of his life was waiting around for what seemed to a lot of people to be the inevitable Nobel Prize. The books that I had adapted, and quite faithfully, I think, were all works of nonfiction, so I couldn't take liberties. There was a real moment of mortification whenever we decided to change something or omit something, or it was tricky.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about the few changes that you did make and why you made them?
Sure. Some of them were at his request. I mean, the name changed 11 was at his request. For me, you know, there were a couple of big changes, one of which was we had to go to points of view that were beyond a 10-year-old Philip who was remembering his childhood from adulthood, which is the structure of the book. That's just too much voiceover for any film to carry successfully. We had to expand the point of view to all the other members of it. And by doing that, I think we opened up the miniseries so that it could cover ground. Roth saw that right away and agreed to that we should, that was the way to go. And then I had another one. I don't want to ruin the end for people, but we did a little something with the end of the book and how the Lindbergh administration concludes. It happens a little fast in the novel and a little magically. And we needed a harder bit of plot. And so we worked hard on that. I was going to show those pages to him. I knew I had an argument on my hands, possibly. But he gave me permission to do it in that I pointed out what I thought was the problem to him without saying what the problem is. And I sat there while Philip Roth, great man of literature, read those two pages over again. It felt like it was probably 4 or 5 minutes. It felt like it was 4 or 5 hours while I was sitting there. And finally, he closed the book and he looked at me and said, well, it's your problem now. And so I took that as permission.
Yeah, yeah. Philip Roth had a reputation for presenting one-dimensional female characters in his novels. And you've made a conscious effort to flesh out the women characters with the help of actors like Zoe Kazan and Winona Ryder. How did this approach help you tell the narrative?
Basically, I just come to characters and I just try to write them as well as I can. And those characters are in the book. And so part of it is just approaching the character and going, okay, it's time to write another point of view and make it credible. But part of it is the actors themselves.
They're after me. I know they are. I have to hide. You have to hide me. You stupid girl. Bess, I'm in danger. I'm afraid.
Don't you think that we're afraid too? Don't you think that we're in danger too?
We're all afraid. People are dead. Evelyn, people are dead. They're going to arrest me. They'll torture me, Bessie. Because I know the truth.
You know, they walk their humanity in front of the camera, and there's no arguing with that.
Mm-hmm. John Turturro plays Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf, and he becomes an important figure in President Lindbergh's administration, which leads to some friction in the Jewish community. What role does this character play in the story arc of your series?
He is the collaborator. He's the court Jew.
Our religion is independent of any piece of land other than this great country to which we commit our total devotion and allegiance as the proudest of citizens. I want Charles Lindbergh to be my president, not in spite of my being a Jew, but because I am a Jew. An American Jew.
We'll understand this dynamic because we've seen it in our own political moment, which is he's not there to convince Jews to vote for Lindbergh. The Jews are very, by and large, very aware of what Lindbergh stands for. But what Bengelsdorf provides for him is a chance to be seen with a prominent Jew.
Does that idiot think one single Jew is going to go out and vote for this anti-Semite because of that stupid lying speech? What does he think he's doing?
Koshering Lindbergh.
Koshering what?
Well, they didn't get him up there to talk to Jews. They didn't buy him off for that. Don't you understand? He's up there talking to the Goyim. He's given all the good Christian folks of this country their personal rabbi's permission to vote for Lindy and not to think themselves Nazis or anti-Semites. Can't you see what they just got the great Lionel Bengelsdorf to do?
There are ways in which people to be very comfortable with some very bad things by holding up one single example of a collaborator.
Mm-hmm. As a Canadian, I really like the storyline about the characters thinking about escaping to Canada. And even though I've been living here in the U.S. for 20 years, those scenes made me feel kind of homesick, which is unusual for me. Do you think that if you had been in Herman Levin's shoes, would you have made that move?
I don't know. Everyone thinks they would have. Everyone thinks they'd get out, that they'd see those, that they'd be able to smell what's coming for them, and they'd have the suitcase packed. I heard a fact along maybe 3 or 4 years that I'd never heard before about the Holocaust. One of the things that a lot of survivors cited when asked why they didn't get out in 35, 36, 37, as the Nuremberg laws came into effect, of all things, a lot of them had grand pianos. It sounds really trifling, but a grand piano was an expensive thing, particularly, you know, from some of the European makers. And all of the Jewish kids were either taking violin lessons and piano lessons, and they'd all invested heavily in this. And they just couldn't believe that Hitler was going to do the things he said he was going to do. They thought eventually everyone will come to their senses. And, you know, while I can pack a bag and I can pack another bag and maybe I can ship this and ship that, the fact that the grand piano came up time and time again is something I'll never forget. Everyone thinks that they would maneuver and maneuver quickly, but people get used to anything, sadly.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite scene or moment in The Plot Against America?
When you ask me that, I don't come up with the dramatic moments because those are carefully scripted, if not written by Roth originally. And they play themselves in the sense of, you got to write them, you got to pace them, you got to shoot them right. But everybody knows their business. The things, when you ask me that, you come up with comedic moments because comedy is ineffable. And you can write a funny line, and then when you see it shot, it's just not where you thought it was going to go. And it's easy for different comic interpretations to send it in different directions. So when something works, when the actor gets the joke, when the actor delivers on the joke, when the comic timing is so hard. Right now, you ask that question, I'm thinking about Winona Ryder is in shul. She goes back to the synagogue, and she's there because she's now being wooed by the rabbi, by Bengelsdorf. And there's a place in one of the prayers, the Aleinu, where you're supposed to literally bow, bend the knee and bow. And all around her, she sees the people bow. First she goes down, and then, of course, they straighten, and she's still bowing, and then she looks up. And all the while, she's trying to mouth the words as if she knows a single word to the prayer, and she does. I watched Winona do that. I think when the dailies came in, I watched them 5 times. I just kept laughing. I thought it was so human. It was so funny.
Lionel, I'm flattered, but the truth is I never even learned my Hebrew letters. I mean, we weren't particularly observant, especially after we lost our grandparents. Shouldn't you be looking to fill this position with somebody better versed in all of this? I mean, I can't tell you the difference between the Talmud and the
Mishnah.
Yeah, it's a great moment. Philip Roth died in 2018. What do you think he would think of your reimagining of his novel?
I will confess to something. When he passed away, the coward that is latent inside as a writer immediately said, well, at least I don't have to do that. Because after we finished filming it, after we were done, and I think we honored what was important in the novel in very, very key ways. And I think the expanded points of view and some of the stuff we did politically with Bengelsdorf and certainly what we did with Alvin at the end, I think it works. And now I would be curious to show it to him and get his reaction, you know, for better or for worse. I now I wish he was here. In every sense.
Mm, Yeah. You've said that what you're trying to do is find a story that's worth telling. And this raises a question about the current state of television. Do you think TV has gotten any better at telling stories that are worth telling?
I think it's gotten bigger. I think there's just so many more stories being told. There are probably more stories that are meaningful and that are well executed, that have a beginning, a middle, and end, and can be seen in some almost literary way as being first-rate storytelling, yes, because there's more of it being done. There's probably much more, in the same light, there's probably much more that's just dross. You used to have, three networks full of dross. Now you have unlimited dross. I'm not sure the percentages are different or that much different, but I see an awful lot of shows that start with a great deal of promise. Universes begin to come together and are built, and premises are off. And then the show either runs out of steam or becomes popular. And that's death for storytelling. Stories have to have a beginning, middle, and end. One of the things I say in a writer's room when we get started on any project is we need to think about where we're going and why. And and in some respects, you write at least in your mind's eye, and sometimes in reality, you write the last page before you write the first page.
Interesting. David Simon, thank you very much. David Simon is the writer, producer, and creator of HBO's The Plot Against America, based on the Philip Roth novel of the same name. Find out more about David and the series at wpr.org/beta.
The thing I like about religion is religion gives you a way to turn your sorrow into grace. So I like to advocate for spirit, not so much for body. I think we get too much body, not enough spirit in the culture.
Musician Eef Barzelay joins us to talk about Clem Snide's album, Forever Just Beyond. That's coming up, Beyond the Break. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.